and welcome to Can Queer, home of Canada's queer media. My name is Luke Smith.
And I am Sebastian.
And we are, I want to apologize, actually, first and foremost, to not only our radio station carriers from coast to coast to coast, but also to our podcast listeners, because this radio show is actually out a day late. And the reason why it's a day late is because we usually record way in advance.
Yeah.
But I didn't get around to editing it until the weekend when I discovered that it wasn't there, that it had vanished. So our 10-minute discussion about impromptu beard hair just has gone. It's just now unreachable. It has vanished into the ether.
Yeah. I mean, I'm very glad and I'm very thankful that it wasn't my fault for once.
No, I assume it's my fault. I mean, it must be my fault. I was responsible for making sure it did not disappear into nothingness.
The software we both use can be, I mean, it's generally reliable, but every so often it does weird persnickety things that are just like, why are you doing this? So, I mean, it's...
Persnickety.
Yeah.
Word of the day. Word of the day. I like that. I write that down. Persnickety.
I wasted my teen years split between reading The Victorians and The Beatniks.
So, I mean, going to say, and the series of unfortunate events, because...
It would fit
really well in that.
It's the kind of language they would use, yeah. But also like William S. Burroughs and Allen Ginsberg and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I grew up with the idea of the radical in the gray flannel suit. You know, you show up looking like everyone else. Yes, ma'am. Thank you, sir. Looking like a gentleman. And as soon as you let them in, as soon as they let you into the cocktail party, that's when you start swearing like a sailor.
I like that.
You know, the idea of like when I see, actually, even when I was a teenager and I saw other teenagers who viewed themselves as radicals by getting like tattoos and piercings and things like that.
Yeah.
It's like people are going to see you from a mile off. You're not going to be able to sneak in the party and upset
things.
There's
no subterfuge.
Yeah.
I mean, I think actually that makes me think that is fundamentally queer. And my understanding here is that sort of that othering, that sort of out of the norm.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of punk in a way, sort of subverting a space.
Which isn't to say that like visibly marking yourself as other doesn't have its own space,
mm-hmm.
but... I don't know. There's just different tactics.
I don't know. That subversion of the norm, I like it. That appeals to me in a very gay way. That's great.
Well, that's where you get the Hunter S. Thompsons of the world. You're like, here's a nice man. Then he shows up. And you're like, I think he's on peyote. Like, really? stay sober, kids.
Absolutely. Safe, sane, and sober. Now, we are going to cover pretty much essentially two big topics this week.
Right.
And we covered them in the show. And since then, there's been some updates.
So
we actually get an updated version of the conversation. We're going to be covering two main topics. One is what's being described as chaotic madness, Toronto Pride turmoil.
Right.
And I think it was actually the CBC. I was listening to some of the coverage, and they mentioned Toronto Pride turmoil. I'm like, that is an amazing headline.
Well, it's normally like Toronto Pride is always chaotic and it's always dramatic, but it's like it's gone from being Coronation Street to being EastEnders,
mm-hmm.
is what's happening.
The second story we'll get to just after our musical break is the incredibly huge news that, actually, I thought it was much bigger news than it is, and I'll get to that later, that the Canadian government...
Sorry.
The news that the Canadian government has issued new guidance on HIV criminalization.
Right.
So not necessarily criminalization, but how these folks should prosecute HIV non-disclosure cases.
And it's not the... having the HIV, it's the transmission thereof.
Yeah. It's transmission without notifying. And we'll go into all of those details later. And if we have time, I want to talk about new NAFTA and a bit of a cheeky workaround that Trump did.
Okay.
As well as Tanzania as well.
Because
we've been talking about it, we may as well stick with it. Now, first of all, what has been decried as an undemocratic and chaotic annual general meeting of the Toronto Pride committee, and we've raised concerns. We talked last week about the fact that now this festival is suddenly academics, and they magically became $450,000 richer from a Public Safety Canada awarded grant, which is very suspicious. Now, at the
we did mention that last week.
We did, yes.
Yeah, the bizarre research program. Well, no, the excellent research program that was put into bizarre hands, where it's supposed to be a nationwide study on the relationship between the LGBTQ community and the police. And granted, the fact that it is largely going to be based out of Vancouver, Montreal, Toronto. What else is a big... Calgary's a big community. Winnipeg's a moderately large community. So it makes sense that it's going to be hosted in a large city, but a pride board, fundamentally, they are a municipal-level organizing community that they're puts a on a festival. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
They're really good at arranging a beer garden and a stage.
They're moderately good at arranging a beer garden and a stage. You say that
because they looked at licensing the street completely tone deaf to the outrage it caused from folks who were like, gay people are addicted to things and you've licensed the street?
Yeah.
What on earth are you thinking? So it seems to be they make a cornucopia of catastrophic mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And this particular one seems, this particular meeting ended abysmally, and we're going to go into a bit of it now.
The one week and a half ago now?
Yeah, it was a recent one. Now, as this is being recorded and released, we are aware that Nuama, the executive director of Toronto Pride and Pride Board, are planning on holding a new AGM because this one was, how would you say, epic fail?
Yeah, they were underprepared, I would say.
Oh, no. They had a plan and a script, except weirdly the entire community didn't follow their plan and script.
Uh-huh.
But I'll get into that. Now, they're planning to have another AGM. Maybe it'll happen before you folks hear this. If so, we will be talking about it in a later episode. It's hard for us to really know what happened because for the first time in Toronto Pride's corporate history, the media was banned from attending.
Right.
There was, out of the gates, first, second, zero transparency in terms of being accountable to the community and accountable to community media, which...
Now, is there... Are they... There's questions that I would have about that. First, are they required? Like, is there some kind of requirement, whether in their own terms and references or in the law, that they do have an open-door policy to the media?
Well, no, except that its entire history...
Okay.
It's had the media.
Okay.
It would be required by convention, if nothing else.
Okay.
So the fact that every single year queer media has been there to report and share what's happening with the community, because that's the role that they play, is not every single Toronto Pride member can fit into that room.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So they look to media and other sources to kind of get an idea of what's going on.
That's not a strong requirement in the grand scheme of things. But here's the other question. Do they have a requirement according to, again, the law or their own terms and references to be open door in general?
Well, no. And that's the same for every nonprofit. So they were well within their rights, except that when you're going from, you're making fundamentally contentious decisions, and then that's when you decide, actually, no, we'd rather close the doors.
Right.
And it's an issue of transparency. The fact that they never, ever before in their entire history have closed the doors on media, but following these unilateral decisions by the executive director and board, they decide, actually, we wouldn't like that spotlight on this particular occasion.
All right.
So it raises questions. We don't know exactly what went in, what went on there. We've heard from folks who were there, including Gary Kinsman, who helped to found Toronto Pride, a significant figure. He spoke to the CBC about what happened. First of all, media's not invited. And just before this meeting takes place, Nuama, who is, and this is in October, who is the executive director of Pride Toronto, decided to unilaterally, as a director, make the decision that Toronto Pride, as Toronto Police Service, as a corporate entity, if they saw wish, can put in an application to Pride to attend. Now, in 2016 and in 2017, at both AGMs, the membership of Toronto Pride have collectively, with a majority, agreed that the Corporation of Toronto Pride Police should not attend the parade. So there is not once, but twice, a mandate from the members to not have the police attend.
Does Toronto Pride have a process for ejecting non-supporting agencies? So, like, this is something that was popularized out of Vancouver where if you want to march in the parade, if you want to set up a booth in the fair, you need to generate evidence. And it doesn't have to be a lot of evidence. You just need to generate some evidence that you have internal HR policies, that you donate to organizations, that you do anything whatsoever throughout the rest of the year to support the fact that you are pro-LGBT. So if, for example, because I'm playing devil's advocate here, like what if the director said the police can apply knowing that they had some kind of internal system that would eject them down the road anyway? Like, is that possible?
So we don't know. I mean, they have significant policies around who can and cannot apply.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the understanding from the community and other folks is that there isn't really anything blocking them. And the reason why the members have made this very high-level decision, and just as a quick primer for folks, the executive director is hired by the board. The board is elected by the membership to represent their interests. So in theory...
And who is the membership?
The members are those who have signed up and paid their dues.
Okay.
So in theory, the will of the membership is much like you think of parliament. You know, the government and the cabinet, you know, will speak.
So it's all... Yeah, there's a lot of community-based NGOs where once a year you pay your $5 and you're a member for the next year. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's that kind of format.
But the organization is supposed to reflect the collective will of those dues-paying members. Now, normally this isn't an issue, except that for 2 years in a row, the membership in the majority gave a clear and concise indication that they do not believe that the Toronto Police Service, unless things have radically changed, deserve to be able to walk in pride.
Yeah.
Now, we spoke the first time you recorded this
about
the fact that, you know, as a gay community, there's a lot of things that we can't do. We can't radically affect change without, you know, it takes time, it takes effort. There are very few tools in our tool belt that we can actually use. And the fact that the parade is ours, the parade is owned by the community. Mm-hmm. It is an expression of how we are pride, have pride in ourselves and pride in each other. And if openly LGBT people want to come, that they're cops, they're more than welcome to. And it doesn't actually ban organizations like Out and Proud, for example. But it is...
It's the institution
It's the corporation of Toronto Pride, Toronto Police Service.
Individual Toronto openly serving police members are welcome to march. Actually, usually they march with Peel anyway, because Peel doesn't have a bad reputation. Is it Peel or York Region? Because there's a whole bunch of regions that surround Toronto that have a very good reputation for dealing with diversity, for dealing with racial issues, for dealing with, like, you know, inter-gang warfare and things like that. And then you actually go into the city and you're just, what are you guys doing
there? Yeah, it's not good.
It's really weird. I like the Vancouver solution. I think that you can get a lot of mileage out of this, where you just have a thing set up where it's like, you know, if in the past, let's say 3 years, you have done anything against the community or you have failed to provide a space for the rest of the year, then you're not allowed to participate. And then everyone could participate, you know, not participate, everyone can apply. You know, the neo-Nazis can apply. They're just going to get ejected. You know, you have that filtration process. Mm-hmm. And if you do that, the police, they can apply all they want. But until it's...
blue in the face.
And wah, wah. Until it's been 3 years since they've cleaned up their act, they're... No. And I think that kind of, like, just mechanize it. Just systematize it, mechanize it, set it off, and just, you know what? Here are the rules. This is what you need to accomplish. You know, you can apply all you want, but you're not going to get accepted until you hit this clear checklist that we've published on our website. That kind of thing, you know?
I mean, it's worth noting, okay, why does the Toronto gay community have such a beef with the Toronto Police Service?
Man.
And I mean,
man.
There are trans folks who go missing. They don't seem to be taken seriously, even up until now. Apparently, there was some outrage on social media about doing the Trans Day of Remembrance on November 20th. Mm-hmm. There was a police crackdown, and there was significant use of force used against trans people at the event.
Well, one of the big thing, it's not that they're not investigating, it's that they wait until like 3 weeks later when the person's been missing for quite a significant period of time, then they go, Oh, yeah, I suppose so. We should probably look into that. But the first 3 days of the critical period? So it's that they're not react. It's not that they're not reacting at all. It's that they're not reacting in a way that's actually going to get you anywhere.
There's also the fact that Toronto had a serial killer on the loose for decades.
Yeah.
Which sounds a bit like, oh my gosh, except the fact that the community knew this. Yeah. And for many years were like, hey, cops, someone's bopping us off. Can you deal with it? And the answer was, frankly, it was badly managed as a police investigation. It's being internally investigated and externally investigated for how badly it was investigated. So there's not only that, but to really the cherry on top of it actually comes from the Ontario Human Rights Commission, who recently just published one of their big reports, and it is the Collective Impact Report.
Right.
They did a study on the Toronto Police Service, and what they found was that between 2013 and 2017, a black person was nearly 20 times more likely than a white person to be involved in a fatal shooting by the Toronto police.
Okay.
And despite being 8.8% of the population, black people make up 30% of police use of force incidents.
Mm-hmm.
When we went there to Toronto following the Bruce MacArthur arrests, we spoke with the Southeast Asian AIDS Alliance, and we were told that they frankly will not call the police for a mugging through to murder. Because why bother? Because there's simply a feeling that the community is there. They're like, we're going to be ignored. We're not going to be taken seriously. We literally had a serial killer on the loose and still weren't taken seriously. So what hope is there? And
well, they could just call 911, they could be like, hi, this is Michael Johnson.
I am Chad. And just like really, really white boy up. I can see what you're saying there,
So there have been a few, like I've read things from criminologists saying that one of the problems with the Bruce MacArthur case was that he violated everything criminologists would expect. Like the profile on him, it's out the window. Like there's all sorts of trends in serial killings, and his profile does not match the profile of his typical victim. So they say on the one hand, the fact that it took longer than expected, there you go. But the number one thing that they're just baffled by is they never actually just asked people.
Mm-hmm.
Like that should have made it take 1.5 times longer than expected, not 10 years longer than expected. So it's one of those things where, like, there's a lot of people saying this was a hard case. It was a very difficult case, but they didn't exactly go around and just say, what do you think you know? Because it was the beginning of the summer of this year where they started actually talking to the community, actually trying to piece together
when a white guy went missing.
Yeah, when and where people were when they're suspected to have gone missing.
I want to say Gary Kinsman, I think, is the name of the white guy.
That's the guy who started Proud. He just said
earlier. Yeah, I did. So why am I bringing all of this up? Why am I talking about this brand new report that clearly defined, like, clearly evidence on the wall, literally 20 times more likely to be shot by cops than white guys?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's shocking. And a part of this goes back to the fact that there was a unilateral decision by Olivia Nuama to decide, actually, you know what? Yeah, police, they can come. Now, in October, she talked to the CBC, and the CBC was like, okay, well, who have you talked to about this? She said, you know, I like to think that I am somebody in the community who has conversations and blah, blah, blah. We've linked to that particular interview, and you can pick it up.
Yeah.
But really didn't give an indication that she'd spoken to anyone. And when questioned at the AGM pre-meeting, a sort of an attempt to clear the air so they could get through business, and she had previously said it was an operational decision.
Okay, yeah.
So it was very much a decision that she had made.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in defending this decision, when everybody in Toronto was like, what the heck? You had one clear, concise instruction.
Well, two. The other being run a festival.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And two being not with TPS.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, everyone's like, what were you thinking? So Nuama actually did a op-ed in the Now Toronto magazine, which...
It's a Toronto magazine called Now. Yes. Yeah. Okay.
Which is so just badly written. It's a ramble.
Yeah.
And it's funny because...
The fact that two-thirds of the article is placing her decision into historical context, yeah, making it into...
There's like indigenous colonization mentioned. This is like the slavery name recent dropped.
Point. If you connect the dots in the great arc of history, it ends with this decision. And it's just like, no, you're running a festival poorly. This does not fit in. Well, I mean, it does now, but it's just fitting yourself into the great arc of history instead of just like, you know... I'm sorry, but future generations get to decide whether or not you're important. You don't write an article where you place yourself into history. That's just, it's awkward and it's a little bit cringy.
And I think what's really, and I haven't told you this, but what's even more cringy is that...
Did she defend it?
Oh, yeah. Oh. Olivia controls the, or has significant control at least, over the official Pride Toronto Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
And the official Pride Toronto Facebook shared... this op-ed.
Yeah.
And there were a great many comment threads with Olivia as the page account was replying and commenting and calling people out for being racist, for critiquing it, and was actually called out on several occasions. They were like, okay, we understand that there's been a lot of personal attacks against you, but why are you using this corporate account and not your own to address that? So that was weird. In terms of official interviews and things, there's been like straight up radio silence from Pride Toronto. But when it comes to Facebook sparring with random people, that seems to be a go. Oh. Now, I mentioned a few times that some of the arguments made is that, you know, you mentioned that it's seen as sort of this end point of history, that clearly the solution here is to work with the community. And I'm actually going to mention the last line. Really, it's the only line worth reading.
This is something that's been bothering me about this. It occurred to me after we recorded the missing episode. This is an elitist approach to a populist movement.
Yeah.
And populism has a bad rap right now. And don't get me wrong, I know that populism has a bad rap right now. But bear in mind, like, I was thinking, like, the populist left used to be things like labor rights and the union movement. There is such a thing as populism done not mean. And the queer movement is a populist movement that is exactly that, is a grassroots movement. Even AIDS research in its early days was a grassroots movement, which is kind of boggling to think of like lab work as being populist. But it was. But yeah, no, it's taking this closed door academic elitist approach to try to quote unquote fix this populist movement is literally the opposite of the spirit of the thing.
So what Olivia writes here is, the Toronto Police Service, along with many agencies that impact all communities of color, must work together to realize change. This is why I invited them to apply to take part in next year's parade.
Mm-hmm.
We are seeking to start a new relationship with real positive outcomes through doing the actual work it will take to make the changes we seek.
Mm-hmm.
Pride strategy has never been isolation. It has been tireless and continuous negotiation. The lives of our children have always depended on the successful outcomes of those conversations.
Oh.
Now, she's been called out as like, what conversations? What exactly have they done that's been any different from the past 2 years?
And I am all for cooperation over hostility. But first you cooperate, then you build a relationship, then you help each other, then you let them march in the parade. Then you wait your 3 years so they can pass this criteria that Vancouver's doing that Toronto's not.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I do think that it does make sense. They do need to work together more. They need to work together more for, you know, the festival security. They need to work more together more for making sure that the officers who show up at the festival are open-minded and they're not racist, homophobes, or sexist or anything like that. And you know, there's a lot of things they could be doing in order to help each other in advance. Are they doing that? And are they doing something other than working on the festival, which is their main mandate? Yeah. Like, I don't... The whole thing is baffling.
Nomama's made this decision that, according to her and her decision, the Toronto Police and them, in order to have a conversation, they need to be in the parade. Whereas the community is like, no.
No.
They improve, then we have a conversation.
Yeah.
Now, easily about a dozen very prominent people of color activists, including multiple professors, multiple co-founders of the Black Lives Matter movement in Toronto, wrote an open letter addressing her op-ed.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to read a quick moment of it here. Nuama wants people to believe that black and BIPOC, that's by an indigenous people of color, black and indigenous people of color, and queer trans struggles were collaborative negotiations that took place between state institutions and our communities. Nothing could be further from the truth.
Mm-hmm.
We can only interpret this misleading impression as an attempt to justify Pride Toronto's refusal to acknowledge the will of its members and oppose police participation in Pride. Nuama is attempting to rewrite the history of BIPOC, trans and queer people to fit a neoliberal white homonormative agenda that harms BIPOC, trans and queer communities. Nuama does not speak for us. She is clearly more content to attend to the political goals of Toronto Police Chief Mark Saunders and Mayor John Tory than to stand with members of the trans communities. Now, bearing in mind that her decision to allow police to attend coincided with the Toronto mayoral election, and there was a big announcement with the now mayor of Toronto again, John Tory.
The language around that article, the response article, also has a bit of an elitism problem.
Absolutely. But I think what it does is really interesting is, like, you know, Nuama tries to spin this yarn about how it's always been, you know, our end goal is clearly working with them and discovery conversations. They're like, no.
Yeah.
And you know what? This is where I point to our listeners, the fact that you are 20 times more likely to be shot if you're black compared to white.
The fact is, the movement in Canada has always been the community just kind of doing its own thing regardless of the law, and then the law catching up to it. So even the first legal same-sex marriage in Canada, the government was tricked into it because it was under the ban wedding system. So it was one of the things that the Unitarians picked up from the Anglicans, which they got from somewhere else, where you don't actually get married on the day of. It's like a 2-week process. Ban as in like banner. And then the banner wedding system, and then they just signed the paperwork, and then the church okayed it, and then the government was like, oh, this paperwork is right. So either we throw out every ban wedding ever done because there's no gender marked on a ban wedding, or we allow gay marriage. And it was sort of like, whoopsie daisy, somebody found a trick. And it was basically just the community was like, oh, that's how you do it. Cool. We're going to do that from now on. And then the government was forced. Like, there's a whole bunch of things where people are doing their own thing, and then the government gets dragged into the future, whether they like it or not.
Well, what's going to be interesting now is whether or not Pride Toronto gets dragged into the future. Because apparently, after this, they attempted to have a pre-meeting just to go over these conversations, and people were peeved.
Oh, yes.
Because this unofficial pre-meeting gave the members absolutely no authority to mandate anything. Okay. Because it's not an actual meeting.
It's not an actual meeting.
So it's literally, it's just a venting exercise. And people saw right through that. We're like, no, that's not acceptable. So when the meeting started, they introduced motions to adopt the agenda, adapt the agenda, introduced motions to introduce new motions under other business, really using the process as one ought to.
Yes.
To force a vote by the membership on whether or not Toronto Police should be allowed to attend. And it is believed, or it has been commentated by several folks who attended, not Pride Toronto or the executive director who has refused media interviews, but it has been noted by other people attending that when it was evident that the membership were pushing to have this discussion, and it was very likely that it would pass and Toronto Police would be told again not to attend, they adjourned the meeting.
I think at this point in time, it's pretty obvious that you and I have both sat on multiple boards.
Yes.
Because this is how we're analyzing it in terms, because I've co-written policy and you've co-written terms and references before, and just looking at all this thinking like, well, what do their documents say? Are they adhering to their own documentation?
And that's the big thing here. You know, but then we're not dealing with noobs. You know what I mean? These people knew what they were doing, and they were like, you are supposed to represent our will. We are going to follow your rules, and we're going to have a conversation. And when Pride Toronto, the board, realized that, they were like, no. And they pulled the plug. And that is why it ended so suddenly, because there was, from what witnesses are saying, a sense that it would push a decision on TPS being refused.
I'm just taking pity on our listeners right now, because they're probably thinking, what is up with these nerds? I will tell you what is up with the two of these nerds. We both live in Ottawa. That's what it is.
It is an
Ottawa thing. We live in brief policy, because if you don't, it's you don't function here. It's annoying. Well, but anyway, sorry. Yes.
The reason why I mention this is because the meeting collapsed.
Yes.
The board pulls the plug. Yes. Now, since then, a significant number of Pride Toronto members, those who are alleging that the board cancelled the meeting before they could have a conversation, and who are alleging the executive director went against their expressed and clear wishes,
mm-hmm.
and now calling for the resignation of both parties.
Yes.
There's even been talk of potential civil disobedience at the Pride Parade. So not only has there been a conversation about going back to square one, a party in the park, as per a recent extra op-ed, but there's also been a conversation about, okay, let's just leave Toronto Pride to the Royal Bank and the police.
Yeah.
They can have it because it doesn't represent us anymore. We're going to make our own thing, which is very queer, let me just say.
Oh, yes.
And it's because they've completely lost faith that this supposed corporate, this supposed organization that represents them collectively no longer seems to do that.
Well, I mean, in many ways, this is the answer anyway, because they estimate anywhere from 1.5 to 3 million attendees at Toronto Pride every year, depending on who's counting and how they're guessing. It's a huge city. It's physically a large city as well. There's already multiple mini prides.
The third biggest city in North America, I think.
It's not. Well, I mean, if you include the suburbs and the greater Toronto area, it does sprawl on forever, and there's a lot of people there. And there's already mini prides everywhere. There's already the Queen West Pride. There's already a picnic in the park in the beaches area. There's already there's a thing in the north end. I can't remember what it's called.
And there's like a radical pride as well.
Yeah, there's little prides everywhere, and it's part of it is just there's so many people there. This is kind of the solution anyway, and I'm all for it. Like if you don't think Pride is representing a group of people that you're a part of, well, anyway, I mean the general solution is, you know, do better, make your own. And that's not an ideal answer, because it means you have to start from scratch.
See, I disagree with you here. I think that if you believe that Pride is not doing well, then you can use your rights as a community member to affect change.
Yeah.
Now, on the one hand, which is hilarious, because on the one hand, I would recommend working within the system, attending the AGM, having a conversation when there's a motion coming up, really being engaged with how Pride is run, except for the fact that they've decided they don't want those conversations, they adjourned the meeting, so
exactly,
good luck with that.
Yeah.
And then the other idea is that really just being a radical approach there and subverting the whole process, sod to the system, let's start fresh. And it's interesting that people are going that sort of more queer route of being like, we're doing something else.
You just agreed with me, though.
No, I know. And I'm agreeing with you because the more sort of homonormative, the more sort of standard approach is not working because the Pride Board of Directors are not listening.
Yeah.
And the executive director is unilaterally making decisions that are unaccountable to the community.
Yeah.
So how can you reflect change? How can you improve if you're not listening?
Yeah.
And that's a real...
Multiple prides. I got no problem with that. I think that's the way to go. And if they're not at the same time, then all the better.
Well, we're playing a song by Janelle Monáe, which was named Album of the Year by NPR in the States. This is I Like That Easy, Stars All Stars, and Michael Goldsmithinger reggae remix. We picked it because reggae just got recognized as a heritage thing by UNESCO, so that's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
This, as I mentioned, is Janelle Monáe, and we'll be back just after this talking about major news in HIV legalization.
Oh, was sitting by you, right before Mr. Ammon's class. Cause my mama couldn't afford new J's polo, thrift stores, thrift clothes, that was all I knew. Do you remember? I remember when you laughed when I cut my perm off and you rated me a 6. I was like, damn. But even back then, with the tears in my eyes, I always knew I was the shit. I like that.
To Can Creole, home of Canada's Cree Major. My name is still Luke Smith.
I'm Sebastian.
We are jumping into a conversation that is not based in Toronto. And we are talking about a directive that has been issued by the Attorney General of Canada, which I'm sure you're thinking, oh my gosh, snooze fest. How can this get any more boring? And I will be...
I mean, we just did spend 20 minutes talking about...
board governance structure.
Board governance, yeah.
This is not the sexiest episode we've ever talked about.
I mean, I'm a huge nerd. I'm happy to talk about plate tectonics for the next 2 hours if you want.
I'm not going to, but we will...
If you want to talk about plate tectonics,
special, yeah.
you can message us.
This has been pretty big news, and it was part of an initiative called... Undetectable equals untransmittable, and refers to HIV.
Right.
And HIV is obviously, as you all know, a virus that affects your immune system.
Yes.
And it makes you much more susceptible to other diseases, yes, etc.
It works by infecting your immune system so that your immune system can't protect you. Like, nobody has ever died of HIV. They die of pneumonia, they die of fungal infections, they die of other infections that their body can't defend them against anymore. So, yeah. I don't know if you knew that.
I did know that.
Okay.
So, undetectable equals untransmittable is the idea that right now in Canada, the law is such, and I will actually make sure I get the right wording of the law, or the gist of the right wording of the law. It is illegal to have sex with someone and not tell them if you have HIV, if the sex acts pose a realistic possibility of passing on the virus. So essentially, if you're HIV positive, you cannot, it is against the law to have sex with somebody and not tell them that you are HIV positive if that act,
yes,
has a realistic chance of transmission.
Yes.
Now, this is important because there have been multiple cases where people have been arrested. I think in Ottawa, there was a case where somebody was arrested for administrating a noxious substance, which is like when you literally poison somebody.
Yeah.
But the substance in question was not necessarily from a poison barrel.
It's one of those things where a lot of people were in support of arresting somebody for deliberately infecting, yeah, other people. But the exact phrasing of the process was a little cringy.
I mean, it's interesting here because what it means is that, and this is where it gets to be undetectable, is where there could literally be no chance.
Yeah.
Where the only chance is like distantly mathematically possible, but in reality is absolutely not a reality. And that's been the challenge. It's been up to judges who are not scientific experts to sort of guesstimate what they think is realistic.
Yes.
And the fact that if you have HIV, it is impossible to remove fully HIV. But it is possible through regular antiretroviral therapy, which is ART, which is the medicine for folks with HIV, that if you take it regularly as per instruction, your percentage of sort of infection to milligram of blood is so low that a generic test actually can't spot it.
Yeah.
So it's not been removed completely because thorough blood work will reveal it, mm-hmm, but it is so tiny,
yeah,
that even if you stockpiled gallons and gallons of it and pumped it into somebody, it's unlikely that they would catch HIV.
Well, gallons and gallons. It's like you can contract HIV from saliva if you swallow, I think it's 5 liters or something crazy like that. Like,
yeah. That's going to take a lot of time. I mean, I have to clear a schedule for that.
I mean, you'd have to freeze some of it in advance, really, is what we're talking about.
It's not good. So the idea here is...
Although freezing it would kill it. So you'd have to get a whole group of people. All right, never mind.
We're going to have to think this through.
But no, I don't want to think this through. That's what I'm getting at. I'm okay with not thinking this through.
The idea is that if you're undetectable, yes, where the basic test literally cannot find it, yes, which means that it is such a tiny, tiny, titchy, tiny element of your blood that it actually, in reality, like in actual reality, poses no real risk of infection.
I think it's below 10 parts per million. So I think they use microliters. So in every microliter, you would have fewer than 8 microliters containing HIV virus. There is an actual calculation.
Yeah, the actual phrasing here is under 200 copies of the virus per milliliter of blood.
Okay.
Because there is no realistic possibility of transmission. So what's happened here is that in the law, if there is a realistic possibility of transmission and you don't tell somebody, you're misleading them, you're not disclosing, or you're lying about your status, that is against the law.
Yeah.
And what they've done in this directive is actually define realistic transmission
by giving it like medical quantification.
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah. And that sort of is the undetectable equals untransmittable. Because right now, prior to this, pretty much any amount of HIV is automatically, it's been really down to judges' discretion. So this directive is a huge deal.
Yes.
What they've announced is this directive from the Attorney General of Canada is that they should not prosecute where the person living with HIV has maintained a suppressed viral load, where it's so tiny it's almost not there.
Yes.
Because there is no realistic chance of transmission. And they should not generally prosecute where the person has not maintained a suppressed viral load, but, so it may not be tiny, it may be just like a normal, like, infectable level of HIV.
Right.
But they have used condoms or engaged only in oral sex, always taking treatment as prescribed unless other risk factors are present. So, for example, the other party may be taking PrEP, which is pre-exposure prophylaxis, which actually prevents catching HIV. The idea there is, like, literally condoms are, believe it or not, super effective.
Yeah.
And it's not realistic. And oral sex, like you said, would take gallons. You know,
well, oral sex would just be 1 gallon. And if you can produce 1 gallon of semen...
I mean, see a medical professional.
Or contact us at...
Talk Anchor. And then it goes on to say that shall not prosecute non-sexual criminal offenses instead of sexual offenses where this would better align with the individual's situation, where the individual's conduct was obviously less blameworthy.
So, yeah, one of the issues, and this actually does neatly fall outside all of this, is that... when you are initially infected, you get a spike in HIV that later on tapers out and then tapers back in over 2 to 20 years. But you're actually at your most infectious within the first 3 weeks after being infected yourself, just like any other virus, just like the flu, just like, I don't know, herpes, just like all the others. The first period immediately after being infected is when you're at your highest, which is also when people generally don't yet know that they have it. So because you don't yet know, and this kind of, I mean, the ignorance is not a defense argument, because there is no reasonable way for you to know the day after you're infected, in that instance, that would not be a criminal offense in that case, even though you might be over the 200 units per milliliter and all that. There's probably a window, like if you don't get tested for 3 years and then all of a sudden you find
out. Well, the idea here is that this directive is really to encourage people to actually step up and get tested. Like you said, ignorance is not permissible under the law.
Yeah.
Which means that just pretend, like refusing to acknowledge a possibility will not protect you if you then are found to have HIV and have not disclosed it to somebody. So that's not a protection. But what this means is that if you do catch HIV, let's say you do get tested and you do catch it, through the actual following of the antiretroviral therapies, your life can return much closer to normal than it has before. You can have a sex life. You can have a sex life and not disclose, assuming that your viral loads are less than 200 per milliliter. I do want to comment on the statement that was issued by the AIDS Committee of Ottawa at the World AIDS Day, December 1st. And they noted, our collective hearts were filled with pride and tears trickling down our cheeks as the same... at the same time as our hands were either up in the air or coming together in thunderous claps, as the Federal Minister of Health, the Honourable Jeanette Petitpas-Taylor, on behalf of the Canadian government, officially endorsed U equals U and signed the consensus agreement. Canada now proudly declares that it is the first country in the world to do so. We are impressed by the leadership of Minister Petitpas-Taylor, and she is a true ally in the fight against HIV stigma and to ensure that PHAs all across the country and the world are able to live dignified lives free of discrimination. A shiny example of government and community working together to eradicate HIV/AIDS. Now, it is a really, really big deal.
Yes.
And it really applies to folk like the RCMP and Northern Territories, because at the provincial level, it's actually the provincial attorney generals that would issue the guidance. So although we're like, this is huge, it may not fully apply to your province. It really does depend on what the guidance is from your provincial attorney general. But this is a really major step, and we hope that this step will actually encourage other provincial attorney generals to also step up and take this in kind of incredible stance. Anyways, we've got a couple of other stories. We're jumping to Gentleman Reg.
So it's actually not safe. Just one thing. I've been looking up, like as you're talking, I went silent because I've been on my phone, but I haven't been a jerk. I've actually been looking up what the cost of at-home test kits are, because part of the reason why this is all motivated is that quick testing has become very affordable, and it's also very subsidized in Canada. And there are pop-ups all over town. So I've heard of the subway in Toronto. Once a week has a place where you can go and get tested for free. And it's just in the subway, and you just go and they do that. It's almost exactly like a diabetes test. Like they take a drop of blood, they do a thing, it takes 30 seconds, they give you your answer. It's not affordable per se. So for $180, you can test for chlamydia, gonorrhea, HIV, syphilis, and trichomoniasis from home.
Well, your local health provider will provide.
But the point is, a lot of this kind of changes to the legal system has been motivated by the fact that testing has become affordable.
And that's at-home testing.
Yeah.
I think if you suspected that you were exposed to risky behavior, may have contracted HIV or HIV.
Yeah.
Talk to your healthcare provider. They will automatically put you up for some. But it's not just doctors. There's also health. There's also community services. But we're jumping to It's Not Safe, Gentleman Reg.
You're not feeling. my swatter. How quickly the ground comes up. Arriving in California on a cloudy day is not what I expected. It's not sea to be naked. Young or green.
Welcome back to Can Queer, home of Canada's queer media. We're just about out of time. And I just wanted to close off with a conversation about the new NAFTA deal, or the USMCA. Right. We mentioned before about the fact that there was a provision in there as part of the Canadian government liberal approach to trade deals. And that provision was about LGBT worker rights and worker right protections.
Yes.
As part of the deal. And there was a multi-senator, like the who's who of homophobes in the US Senate, wrote a letter to Trump being like, "Grr, this is awful. We can't undo all of those protections if this is in place." And then everyone's like, "So Trudeau, like, are you going to stop them from removing this? What are you going to do to make sure that these LGBT protections are in there, not just for Canada, but also Mexico and the US?" It's one of the give and take. We talk about weird things that are in this agreement.
Oh, NAFTA's bizarre. Top to bottom, it's bizarre.
It is. I wanted to mention it because obviously it was signed a few weeks ago. Mm-hmm. But one of the things not many people are talking about is that in the final version that got approved like minutes before they signed it, they scribbled in a footnote on the page about LGBT rights. And the footnote reads, "The United States' existing federal agency policies regarding the hiring of federal workers are sufficient to fulfill the obligations set forth in this article. The article thus requires no additional action on the part of the United States, including any amendments to Title VII of Civil Rights Act 1964, in order for the United States to be in compliance with the obligations set forth in the article." Essentially,
what does, translate this for
essentially, what does this mean? This very last minute footnote says that the United States will introduce absolutely no new protections. What's interesting here is that it says as is.
Yeah.
So it means that really there's a bit of a roadblock on Republicans repealing the few protections that exist.
Yeah.
But it does mean that this treaty will not obligate them to add any more. But I just wanted to note that this is something that happened at the 11th hour. And it's a bit of a win-lose.
It's, you know, weird, yeah. I mean, I always feel awkward when one country tells another country what to do. And I think documents like this, and the things in there about workers, I mean, it does come down to workers' rights, which is one of the reasons why I'm like, as much as I'm a little bit about telling other countries what laws they must and must not pass, this is an agreement to do with trade, and it's an agreement to do with labor. Mm-hmm. So this is an instance where it makes sense.
Unfortunately, listeners, that's all we've got time for. Aww. We're playing out with Runaway Love from Diamond Rings. I've been Luke Smith.
And I have been Sebastian. Thank you for listening.